On this episode of The Big Number, we debate Wemby versus SGA for NBA MVP and dive into the stats to see who has the stronger case. Plus, is it time to ditch the 65-game rule for NBA awards? All this and more coming up right now. Welcome, 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 welcome to The Big Number. I am Tom Haberstroh, and we do this every Wednesday here at Yahoo Sports. If you haven't already, go hit that subscribe button on our YouTube channel, Yahoo NBA. I know you're subscribed, Dan, because you're our man. He's my man, Dan Devine. Dan, what's going on?
Contractually obligated to be subscribed, but also would have done it on my own, just for the vibes and for the sake of getting that good, good content pipeline. I'm doing great, Tom. We are approaching the final sprint here. It's a couple of weeks left in the season, and there's playoff implications, there's seeding races, there's all sorts of stuff. But really what people are interested in now is award stuff. And I have a feeling that we're going to get into a pretty big, literally and figuratively, swing piece in that awards discussion. So hit me with it, Tom. Let's put up some numbers. What is this week's big number?
Dan, this week's big number is 16.5. That's Victor Wembanyama's on-off swing this season, which leads the entire NBA. Now, what is on-off swing? That is at our friends cleaning the glass, a figure from there that calculates what is the swing in your team's net rating when you're on the floor versus when you're off the floor. It basically approximates your impact on the scoreboard, considering when you're on the floor and on the bench. And the plus 16.5 swing on that points per 100 possession scale is the largest such swing in the NBA. And then, Dan, this is what I think is going to be his biggest case in the MVP vote, is just the guy when he's out there, he changes everything on both ends of the floor. And the only one who comes close to him on this swing factor, mostly on the offensive end, is Nikola Jokic, three-time MVP, who's also an MVP candidate for the Denver Nuggets. But if you're just looking at what is this guy's impact, how does he affect scoring on both ends of the floor, it's hard to come up with anyone who on a per-minute basis does more than Big Vic. What he did the other night against the Miami Heat, what he's done for the past, 22 games, any sample over the past month or so, he's arguably been more impactful, more dialed in on winning and doing more for his team to win basketball games than anyone. And I think he really wants this. Like if the season ended today, I'd give long, hard thought to giving him the MVP over Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. I probably would still lean towards Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Dan. But we're here, 10 games left in the season, and the door is open. And it seems like Victor Wembanyama is ready to do this. I thought he would not be in the conversation because of all the games lost. But based on the quote that he gave after the game against the Miami Heat, Dan, I feel like isn't it refreshing to hear a guy care this much about winning and impact and playing every game and playing to the very end? Dan, this is exciting. 10 games left, we're here. And it feels like one of the biggest names, the biggest players in the sport, the biggest player in the sport, really appreciates the integrity of this game enough that he wants this award and wants to win as many games going forward and play in as many games going forward.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we have the audio sort of queued up for of what he said when he actually sort of made his case, which was asked to, I believe it was Jared Weiss at The Athletic asked the question of, basically, what's your case? What's your argument for MVP? And it was about as concise and succinct a three-point plan as you're going to hear from an athlete in that situation.
My first one would be that defense is 50% of the game and that it is undervalued so far in the MVP race because I believe I'm the most impactful player defensively in the league. Second argument would be that we almost swept OKC in the season and we dominated them three times with their real team and four times with more rotation players. And my third argument would be that offense impact is not just points.
Ooh.
Ooh. I think there's a lot to be, it's a pretty rich text. I also love, and it's not in that clip, but he said sort of in a subsequent response that like his job is over the next 10 games to end this debate. Like he wants to over the final, these closing 10 games, render this a moot point, the discussion. And I'd like, yeah, to your point, that attitude of my job is to make a bulletproof, ironclad affirmative argument for myself over these last 10 games. Like it is what you're looking for. Our guy Tom Zilla wrote about it in his newsletter, Good Morning, It's Basketball Today. Like the idea that this is so refreshing that there's no, while Victor obviously has had plenty of media training and has the understanding of how to communicate the way he wants to in his second, third language, whatever it is, as impressive as that is, it doesn't feel so like anodyne or so antiseptic in the way that some other prospects that come through, the pipeline of being elite prospects sound. Like he's actually willing to say what he thinks and what he means. And what he means is, I'm better than everybody. And that is to be expected. It's like somebody who was born to rule and who has sort of grown up his whole life with the understanding of at a certain point, I will assume the throne. And this is all to be expected. And I don't know that anybody expected the assumption would happen this soon, but he is certainly mounting a pretty convincing argument for it on the floor.
Yeah, I'm conflicted here, Dan, because number one, I would say I should be campaigning on his behalf because I picked him to win MVP before the season. But I also recognize he still has some work to do, Dan. Like they've won 11 straight games with Wemby in uniform. They've won 22 out of their last 23 games with Wemby in uniform. But he hasn't been in uniform as much as Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. So if there's one thing that I would say that he needs to do from here on out, it's go 10-0 to finish the season and play in every 10 one of those games. Like that to me, if it's going to happen, I think it still can happen. I think Victor Wembanyama absolutely can win MVP this year. Right now, according to BetMGM odds, right now we have Victor Wembanyama at plus 1,000, Luka Doncic at plus 900, and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is the favorite at minus 800. It's a big, big gap between Shai and the rest of the field there. But I honestly can sit here and say at 10 games left in the season, it's not over. And Victor Wembanyama, his point about OKC in the standings is a really good one. Not only do they have that season series, but I think there's a chance, Dan, that they win the Western Conference. And at that point, I think Wemby wins it. If you look at the strength of schedule going forward, the Oklahoma City Thunder not only have Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who probably wants to win a championship a little bit more than Wemby. Of course, he says all the right things about trying to win it all. But at this point, Shai has already won the MVP, so I can understand if he's like, I'm going to take a couple games off at the end of the regular season just to make sure my body's right for this stretch run. And the schedule for the Oklahoma City Thunder are really tough. If you look at their strength of schedule, they have the hardest opponent win percentage in the NBA. That usually doesn't happen because they can't play themselves. The best team in the NBA can't play themselves. And so usually they have an easier strength of schedule because there's no chance that they can play this other team, Oklahoma City, because it's them. So when you look at the actual schedule, the Thunder, they still have to play at Boston, against New York, the Pistons. They play the Lakers twice, the Clippers, Nuggets, Suns. 8 of their next 10 games are against 500 teams or better. Contrast that to San Antonio. And so San Antonio only has 4 500 teams or better left on their slate. So the other piece of this is that they have the tiebreaker. The Spurs do. So yes, they're behind by 3 games. But if they are tied in the standings, they are going to be the number one overall seed with OKC. And our friends over at dunksandthrees.com say, what is it, about a 6% chance that they can that they will end up with the number one overall seed. So the door is still there. The door is open. But I think Wemby has to play every single game and continue playing at this level, statistically, individually, both ends of the floor. He's I think, got a very great case, but it just comes down to those minutes played, and he's missed 12 more games than SGA, and he's played fewer than 300 minutes compared to SGA's total. So, Dan, what do you think about Wemby's chances right now? Do you agree with the odds there that we saw earlier, or do you think it's actually understating what Wemby's chances are?
I think the recent both explosion for San Antonio, where he got 22-1 over the last 23 games with him in the lineup. It's preposterous. They've lost twice since the beginning of February. Like, they've been absolutely sensational. I think that combined with Denver having some struggles and Jokic being in, you know, to a minuscule degree, like slightly less Jokic-y than he has than previous examples since coming back from his knee injury. I think those things maybe have allowed Wemby to jump up to two in the theoretical horse race here, right? And then obviously Cade going down and whatever the you know, whoever else was in that top five mix, I think Wemby puts himself in as sort of the number two spot there. The thing is, yeah, like you're right that I think they might need to either win out or obviously like outperform OKC by a couple of games here down the stretch, because even though they've gone whatever it is 22-2 since the beginning of February, they've only made up a couple of games in the standings because OKC has also gone 19-4 in that stretch, and they still have that lead in the standings. And you mentioned SGA potentially, you know, maybe resting because he doesn't, you know, he's already won the awards, he has the accolades, but like he still needs to play at least five games to get to 65. You know, he missed time with his own injury, so to get eligible for, you know, MVP, to get eligible for All-NBA, he still has to play at least five games. The Thunder still want to hold off Oklahoma, San Antonio for that number one seed. And then there's also the rhythm component if you're Oklahoma City, right? Like they just got Jalen Williams back again. You look at their preferred starting five, the starting five that won the title last year, that lineup has played 52 total minutes this year, six games. That's it. That's all the amount of time that OKC has had Shea and J-Dub and Isaiah Hartenstein and Chet Holmgren and Lu Dort on the floor together. That's all. So like they could use some reps. Yeah, obviously those guys know how to play together, but I think you'd like to see everybody get some reps. So yeah, I think you're going to see OKC's A team down the stretch, all of which I think makes it tougher to envision San Antonio making up the gap in the standings, Wemby making up the gap in minutes played, all those sorts of things. So the chances are good. And we've talked about this. We had talked about it before, I believe about a month ago when we were sort of taking stock of the MVP race, that basically being the main pillar of Wemby's case. I think we have that as well. The idea that if San Antonio was able to overtake OKC in the standings, it would do an awful lot for Wemby's case. 44%. Those are the odds as of Wednesday morning that Mike Bowie at Inpredictable.com gives the San Antonio Spurs of finishing with the Western Conference's number one seed, the top spot in the West, 44%. I'm guessing by your response to that, that you had the same reaction that I did, which is it kind of blew my hair back when I saw that this morning. Well, Oklahoma City has the West's second toughest remaining schedule, according to Tankathon. Yep. The Spurs are sixth. Their opponent's total winning percentage the rest of the way is like just above 500. The Spurs have won nine straight. They have the NBA's best record since the start of December. If the Spurs pull this off, does this thing maybe just become Victor Wembanyama's award to lose? Do you ever get psyched when we do that we're not wearing the same shirts? Like I always get a little worried that when we go to a clip from the past, I'm just going to look exactly the same and people are going to think I have two t-shirts. Crisis averted. Very nice. But yeah, so I mean, to the points that we're raising here, like Victor Wembanyama has put himself in position to reach for that brass ring, you know, and he wants all of it. He wants to be Defensive Player of the Year. He wants to be a unanimous Defensive Player of the Year. He wants to win MVP. He wants to win 60 games and he wants to win a title and he wants it all now. And, when you get within arm, I mean, his arm's reach is a lot longer than everybody else's. So he might be able to reach out and grab this thing over the next 10 games if a couple things break right.
What do you make of that comment about defense is 50% of the game? Because I think he's saying, look, SGA, as good as he is defensively, they've got a host of better defenders on their team. No knock on him. And he's an excellent perimeter defender. However, watch like 10 minutes of Wemby this season. Right. And it's no question who is the better defender. And I think if you're a big man like Wemby, you can have 50% of your value on the defensive end. But for guards like Jaylen Brown and Luka and SGA, I don't think their value is 50% of the game or their value. I think for lead guards like that, typically you see their offensive side of their game is way more important at that size. Whereas for bigs, you can have a lot of your value on that end of the floor. And so I think he's smart. Victor Wemby, clearly very smart and eloquent. He laid out an incredible case here, starting with the defense. And According to our friends at cleaningtheglass.com, his impact defensively is in the 99th percentile, meaning when he's on the floor versus off the floor, the Spurs, I mean, we could go through a whole line of points about how Wemby changes. I think their two-point field goals allowed stretch out even further when he's on the floor. I think we I looked this up yesterday, that the rim attempts per 100 possessions, he cuts out four of those per game, per 100 possessions. They just don't attack Wemby when he's in there nearly as much as when he's on the floor. But then again, you got Luke Kornet as your backup. So it's almost like it understates how much he erases the most coveted real estate in the game, the rim area, the paint. He just erases and shrinks the floor for the opposing offense. And that's his biggest case here. And when you look at that, when you look at that data, Shea isn't nearly as good defensively as Victor Wembanyama, which is kind of obvious. But if he's, let's say, 20% better defensively, Wemby is, is he 20% worse than Shai Gilgeous-Alexander offensively? And that's where the argument gets really interesting, is Wemby has gotten a lot more aggressive when it comes to his scoring. He's gotten a little bit more three-point happy as of late, and he's been hitting those shots, so you can't argue with it. But when we talked about this before the season, Dan, he was a lot more rim-oriented and post-ups and attacking the basket this season under Mitch Johnson. And he's been a little bit more balanced in that respect recently, but when he's playing this well offensively, that gap between him and Shai on that end of the floor is razor thin. And so if you're saying he's better than him, way better than him defensively, and the defensive impact is 99th percentile, man, he's got a great case over the last month. And if he continues this trajectory, man, over the next 10 games, and they get the number one standings in the number one seed in the standings, I think it's Wemby. And I think that BetMGM odds right there, I think it's very, very understating his case. I think it's a lot higher than that, what that suggests with like an implied value of like 5 or 10%. I think it's probably closer to 25% Wemby's case to winning it, because I think he wants it. I think he's going to try to play every game. And just as we saw with Cade Cunningham, weird things happen. You get a knee or an elbow to the back and suddenly a partially collapsed lung happens in a game. And unfortunately, I think because they're human beings and this is a contact sport, I think it's not over with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander being the MVP. I don't think it's a lock. And I think Wemby has a much better case than those odds suggest.
I would agree. I mean, and just for the, I guess, for the purposes of putting this on the record somewhere, like, I am somebody who has had actual year-end awards vote. I believe I will have one again this year. I had one for All-Star. Usually, like, those things are connected. I don't know what I'm going to do yet, because I try to procrastinate as much as humanly possible on those things before I actually have to make the decision. So I don't know which way I would lean yet. What I would say,
you don't know where you would lean right now. If the ballot came in today, what you would say in this hypothetical?
I guess what I mean is, like, I try not to say that because I don't want to, like, you know, put myself in a position where I then have to backtrack and then argue against myself. You know, like, it's not particularly fun to do that. But I think if your arguments for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander heading into the final few weeks of the season were best player on best team, the, you know, overwhelming offensive, you know, both volume and efficiency, the degree to which he avoids turnovers, and then because of that elevates the entire OKC offense, and then some other things that we're about to talk about, I believe. I think nothing that would make the affirmative case for SGA has changed. I think the thing that would impact your thinking is just, has Wembanyama made a strong enough case for himself with, as you mentioned, the value he brings on the defensive end of the court? One fun thing to do when you're watching a Wemby game, if you ever, like, I have to take notes on games sometimes, right, for what I'm going to write, as you're going through the possessions, is how many times you wrote, like, Wemby, hell no. Wemby, nope. And that is when somebody gets towards the paint and they just stop, or they pass out, or they dribble through and go somewhere else because they don't even want to think about trying to take a shot at that. How many times you have, like, do the control F find how many times you wrote hell no or nope in your notes? Because chances are it's going to be at least a handful, probably two times that he just, a shot disappears because he's there. All that to say, I think the idea of Wembanyama saying, like, offense is more than just points is true. I think boiling down Shai Gilgeous-Alexander's offensive impact too. He scores a lot, is somewhat a diminishing of the overall value of what SGA brings to the table. And maybe we'll talk about a little bit about that as we move on in the show. But I think it is a fun subplot, recent development to have Wemby assert himself so forcefully in the discussion at this late stage of the season. And it gives or both, you know, like it makes the top of the Western Conference fascinating to watch over these final 10 games.
Well, you know what? I think Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, for me, I would vote him for MVP right now. But I feel like with 10 games to go, like you said, we can react to different information as new information arrives. And I think that new information, there is a scenario in which I will sit here in a month's time and say, yeah, Victor Wembanyama deserved to win the MVP this season. I thought this ascension was coming. I figured that his cerebral mental side of the game, that he really absolutely wants this. He's about this life. And the improvement that we saw, the trajectory that he was on last year, it felt like this was going to be the year for him. And Shai Gilgeous-Alexander got hurt with that abdominal strain, and the door is still open. So I can't wait to see how the rest of the season finishes out. But you know what? If you were going to vote for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander right now, Dan, we're going to go through what his case is. We just talked about Wemby, but Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has been outstanding. We're going to break down his case right after the break with your three little numbers. All right, Dan, today's big number is plus 16.5. That is the point swing for Victor Wembanyama's team, the Spurs, when he's on the floor versus off the floor. Best, biggest, largest swing. Of course it is for the guy who is the biggest guy in the league, Victor Wembanyama. But that's not everything when it comes to the MVP case. And although I think he has a very strong case, I think Shai Gilgeous-Alexander might have a slightly better one. We're going to break down why Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is at the top of that MVP race in the expectations and the perception. With your first little number, what do you got?
First little number this week is one, as in first, which is where Shai Gilgeous-Alexander ranks in. Estimated plus minus, EPM wins, win shares per 48 minutes, Jeremias Engelman's XRAPM, win probability added, Neil Payne's Laker, among many other metrics that are the all-in-one variety that try to get at how much a player is impacting his team's chances of winning on the floor. This includes clutch win probability added, according to Mike Bowie's numbers at Unpredictable. Second shot from Mike this episode. Where SGA is tied with Nikola Jokic for the most direct impact on his team's chances of winning in close and late clutch situations. Victor Wembanyama, sixth in those situations. This stands to reason since SGA leads the NBA in points scored in the final 5 minutes when the score is within 5 points. He's shooting 49% in those situations, 19-5 assist to turnover ratio. And in the clutch, when he's got a chance to tie or take the lead, the extra clutch shots, the tie or take the lead shots, 55% from the field with a bunch of game winners to his credit. And most of the ones, those other all advanced all-in-one metrics that he doesn't lead in, you know, stuff like value over replacement player or box plus minus, player efficiency rating, he still leads Wemby in those. The guy that leads in those categories is Jokic, not Victor Wembanyama. So generally speaking, even if you go down to the most like basic plus minus, which is just plus minus how much your team outscores the opponents by when you are on the floor, plus 653 for SGA, number one in the league ahead of Victor Wembanyama. So your case, as far as I'm concerned, for SGA starts with all of those fancy numbers that have been the bailiwick and the driving force, the bellwether for the Jokic argument over all these years. SGA leads all of them now, and he leads all of them while being the number one guy on the number one team in the NBA. So I think that's a pretty good place to start with the argument.
Yeah, and I don't want to make this just an analytics, guys. The nerds love SGA because I don't think that's accurate, but the numbers are what they are. And
it's not called the big feelings, Tom. It's called the big number.
We should do a new show called the Big Vibes. You know, that should be the new show. Maybe on April Fool's. It's coming up. I don't know if we can do that for next week. But
TM.
Your point is, it's pretty convincing. And I noticed that he did not say in Victor Wembanyama did not say in his speech, I'm third in EPM. I'm fourth in this. Like he's not leaning on the analytical numbers because he understands that in terms of these metrics, not only is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander outrageously efficient, he keeps turnovers way down, which it's not just about points. It's the consistency, 132 straight games with at least 20 points. And he's averaging just 2.2 turnovers per game. With the scoring and 6.6 assists per game, it's absurd. You know, considering he's generating what? Just doing the back and the napkin math there, 45, 48 points per game and only having 2 turnovers per game. So it's that. It's not a sexy thing to talk about, but the consistency and the fact that it's almost mistake-free basketball is why it's not just about points per game and scoring for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. It's that he shows up and it's a metronome of greatness every single time he's out on the floor. He has just the cachet of, I just beat Wilt Chamberlain in a record that no one thought was going to be beat ever again. So there's that kind of top line headline story that you can look back on this season and say, I mean, think about that. He just passed Wilt Chamberlain for most games in a row with at least 20 points. And so I think that's important. And I think the biggest thing there that you mentioned is the clutch. The clutch stuff is unreal. Like, he doesn't play fourth quarters, but when he does, he drinks Dos Equis. You know, he's a guy that very rarely do they need him to come up big in fourth quarter situations or in clutch situations. And he has been the best closer in the NBA. And Daryl Morey likes to say the best closer in the NBA is one that you don't even need to close the game because the game's already out of hand. And for the most part, that is true for OKC. Is the best closer is, you know, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, because he's so dominant in the first 36 minutes that he doesn't even need to be out there. He can just kick his feet up. But you can't ignore the scoring in clutch situations just in general. 156 points in 114 minutes. He has more points than minutes in clutch situations. Number two in the NBA in clutch scoring is Jamal Murray at 147. So Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is at 156. Points within 5 minutes in the final five, game within five in the final 5 minutes. So SGA has a little bit of a lead in points, just sheer points. But he's played in 40 fewer minutes than Jamal Murray and still has more points than him in clutch scenarios. He's 49% field goal percentage in those scenarios. He has 19 assists and just 5 turnovers. So Dan, when the lights are brightest for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, when he is needed and called upon to close the door for OKC, he has been undoubtedly the best player in those highly leveraged moments. And if you want a best, most valuable player, that's the case. Not only in those per game metrics, not only in the leaderboard and the standings that he's on the best team, but also in those super high leverage moments. When it's a bounce here, a turnover there, a shot there, it's not him living at the free throw line. Because guess what? Jamal Murray has more free throws in clutch minutes than Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. It's because he's so good at controlling the ball, getting to where he needs to be. And when he needs to be a winning player, man, he delivers time in and time out. So yeah, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, number one in just about every all-in-one metric because of those minutes played and that greatness, but also because he has been great in those little slivers of time where it matters so much for you to be great.
And to that point about ball control, here's another one. Our friends at Stathead, we slice up the data on there, right? All the searches and filters. Players in NBA history, since they started tracking some of these things, usage rate of more than 30%, so superstar workload. True shooting percentage above 650, so elite scoring efficiency. Turnover percentage less than 10% of the time. You do not cough the ball up. One guy, SGA this season. So We'll put a button on the one there and we'll move on to our second little number this week, which is 15.0. That is SGA's gravity score, according to NBA Advanced Stats. And this is a new number that the NBA, through their partnership with Amazon, introduced this season as part of their Inside the Game coverage. It aims to quantify how much a player pulls defenders toward them, essentially measuring how much attention they draw compared to what the spacing on the floor would predict. I thought this was an interesting number to look at because when Wemby made his argument, he said offense is about more than points. So I said, I wonder if, and it would make sense, right? The 7 foot five guy being the one that draws more attention to him. You got to put more bodies on him to keep him away from the rim, right? Well, SGA's gravity score, 15.0. That's third in the NBA behind Kevin Durant and Anthony Edwards. Victor Wembanyama's gravity score, 8.7, 19th in the NBA. So by their metrics here, SGA more gravity than Victor Wembanyama. Now you might say, well, okay, sure. SGA's got the ball in his hands all the time, right? More touches, more time in possession. A guy that has the ball more is going to get more attention. So if you just sort of looked at the off-ball stuff, or when Victor doesn't have the ball and SGA doesn't have the ball, probably levels out. However, off-ball gravity, SGA leads the league in off-ball perimeter gravity score. And then on the interior, around the basket, he's third behind KD and Kawhi Leonard. Victor Wembanyama, again, further down on those lists, which is to say, no one's saying that, like, if you had a question of who you're going to throw the lob to, you're going to throw it to SGA versus Victor Wembanyama. But that argument about what a player does, how their presence impacts spacing, how that impacts the, you know, defensive coverages, your shifts, the way you load up. Teams throw so much attention to the box to keep SGA out of driving lanes. And what that opens up for all those shooters on OKC, everybody else's job gets easier. The offense flows through that and emanates from that. And so, yes, correct. Offense is not only about points. It's also about what you create for everybody else. And it's worth noting that when SGA is on the floor, OKC scores like the number one offense in the NBA. And when he's not, they score like a bottom five offense in the NBA. Combine that with points created, right? We talk about not just points scored, points created. Among guys that have played at least 40 games, SGA is third in the NBA behind only Jokic and Luka. So it's not just the points he scores. It's the points he creates via assist. It's the attention he draws. It's the gravity he has. I think there's an argument that while Wemby made a good argument for the not just the points thing, he might have made it in the favor of the guy he's arguing against.
Yeah, and when you're so sure-handed that you can get to wherever you want to go and get a good shot off, and he's a contortionist. Like, he's a guy that even if you have two guys draped over him, a la Michael Jordan, a la Kobe Bryant, he's going to find a way to get his look. And isolation numbers this year, the reason why he's got so much gravity when he has the ball is because you can't guard him one-on-one. Like, nobody can guard this guy one-on-one. You need to throw multiple bodies. He tilts the floor towards him so much because of this fact here. He leads the NBA in isolation points despite missing a bunch of games this year. His efficiency in isolation, according to Synergy, is 98th percentile, 1.18 points every possession when he's got that ISO. So when you talk about James Harden and the ISOs that he used to do, and still does for sure, but peak James Harden on the Rockets, that's what Shea is right now. He lives more in the mid-range than James Harden did, but the fact that he's this efficient and still people can't figure out how to guard this guy one-on-one on an island is the reason why he has so much of that on-ball gravity. He's not going to turn the ball over, right? And this is why a lot of teams, while it's not aesthetically pleasing, they prefer this ISO basketball a la Mike D'Antoni and James Harden because it limits your turnovers. If you got a guy that is so sure-handed and mistake-free basketball, you can just give him the ball and you got to throw multiple defenders at him just to cut out his airspace and try to get him to, you know, fumble into a bad shot or a turnover. It rarely happens with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, which is why he has so much gravity. His three-point shot is improved. And so there's just really no weakness for him. He's not he's not the same passer that Luka Doncic is and playmaking for others. And part of that is because he doesn't need to. He can get an extremely high percentage look almost every time down the floor. And there's just no guarding him one-on-one anymore. And he's proven that. Even after a year in which he won the championship and the MVP and the finals MVP, doesn't matter. He's still unguardable in one-on-one.
Which brings us to our third and final little number this week. 872, which is how many minutes this season Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has played without either Jalen Williams or Chet Holmgren. This was one of the big arguments in two years ago about SGA. Like, well, he's got like all NBA, all-star supporting cast. Like, Jokic doesn't have that. Other guys don't have that. Well, this season, he hasn't had that for a lot of the season. Jalen Williams has barely played. Chet missed a chunk of time too. 872 minutes where SGA has the ball without those two star level players with him. The Thunder have won those minutes by 223 points. That's a plus 11.5 points per 100 possession net rating, which, you know, would lead the league. They have scored just under 120 points per 100 possessions in those minutes, which would be a, you know, top four offense in the NBA for the full season. So when you make the arguments that, like, well, the Spurs would capsize without Wemby, the Nuggets would be nowhere without Jokic, the Lakers would be nothing without Luka, and so on and so on and so on. The implied other position is OKC would be fine if those other guys were the ones running the show without OKC, or without SGA rather. And in the specific sample of this season, whether that might be true generally or in a simulation, this season, they haven't had those guys, and they've been elite with him available, and they've been like meh with him not available. And that's the difference. The value is he makes everybody else, whoever's in, whoever's out. OKC, I believe, has lost more player games due to injury this season than any team but the Grizzlies, according to SpotTrack's tracking. No matter who's in, who's out. If he's out there, they're elite. And that's the value proposition. You can say the on-off split that factors in how bad they are when he's not on the floor. But when he's on the floor, they're about as good as it gets, and kind of no matter who's around him. And there's, I think, a pretty good value argument for that.
Isn't it strange how both teams have been pretty good without their MVPs? Like, Victor Wembanyama, when he's not out on the floor, the Spurs are 10-5 this season. And when Shai Gilgeous-Alexander's not on the floor, they're 8-4. So they both don't have the case of, like, kind of, I don't want to say this, that my teammates can't do anything when I'm not there. look at the record when I don't play. That's not a good argument for either of these guys. And on Illuminati this week, we talked about how if Luka wants to really get into this mix, he just needs to miss a few games here and have the Lakers tank those games, because that's the only thing that I could see Luka getting ahead of both of these guys. Is the Lakers are 6-6 without Luka Doncic in uniform, and among all MVP candidates, you look at Jaylen Brown. Without Jaylen Brown, the Celtics are 6-1. Without Cade Cunningham, the Pistons are 8-2. Without Wemby, the Spurs are 10-5. Without Jokic, the Nuggets are 11-6. Like, you add up all of these numbers, and it's like, okay, well, how valuable are these guys? And the point you're making is, well, without Chet or J-Dub, the Thunder are still going to get the number one overall seed, looks like. And he's still the number one in plus minus. So, like, when dealt a bad hand injury-wise to his teammates, that you're right, no team other than the Memphis Grizzlies have lost more player games due to injury than the Oklahoma City Thunder, and they're still handily winning the Western Conference this year. So, man, I don't think people realize how many injuries the Thunder have suffered this year, including Shai Gilgeous-Alexander with that abdominal strain. But they're not just coasting to the number one overall seed because they've just had an unusually lucky year. They've been dealing with some blows injury-wise, and they've been able to sustain because of that guy, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander.
And so this is, I mean, you gave me a pretty fun assignment, which was like, make the case for why the reigning MVP, who's the best guy on the number one seed, should be considered for that award again. Like, it wasn't exactly rocket science to come up with some numbers here, but I think it, if nothing else, casts it into relief. Like, yes, there's a great affirmative case for Wembanyama. That does not mean that there is not also a great affirmative case for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, similar to, and you know, we didn't talk about them in any great detail in this episode. We've talked about Luka the last few weeks, Luka Doncic in LA. We've talked about Jokic before in Denver. Like, there are great cases for other players that you can make in an affirmative way. Like, this is why this guy deserves to be considered. That does not necessarily require trying to dismantle somebody else's case or diminish what somebody else has achieved in their context with their team. I would say I'm hopeful that we can make those cases without needing to crap on somebody else over the course of these next 10 games, few weeks. I could say my hope might not necessarily be founded in my experience of what the home stretch of MVP award discussion becomes. But listen, all we can do is our part. And I think we've done a pretty decent job in this episode of saying, here's what the argument for Wembanyama would be. Here's what the argument for SGA might look like. You know, draw your own conclusions from there.
It's so good that Victor is making this charge. I think it's great for the league. I think Victor has been fantastic as an ambassador for the NBA brand, that he really cares about this stuff and that he's ascending way quicker than people expected. You know, like he's already in the mix for MVP at 22 years old, which is something that we very rarely see in this league. He's surpassed expectations, and the fact that he's already arrived, the takeover is here, and we'll see if he can do enough over the final 10 games to really make this interesting. So Dan, on that note, to keep things positive and not talking about how much these guys are missing, how many games these guys are missing, the Players Union is coming out with two statements on Tuesday. Not just one, but two statements, public statements, arguing for reform for the league, or at least some action by the league to stick up for the players here on a couple of things. So we're going to talk about the Cade Cunningham situation and Giannis Antetokounmpo. And we also have some news that we need to tackle regarding expansion coming up after the break. All right, Dan, we've talked about Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. We talked about Victor Wembanyama, a little bit of Luka last week and a little touch there. But we haven't talked about Cade Cunningham and Giannis because they've been out for quite a while here. And the NBPA has some statements for us, for the league, for everybody to understand the situation here. I wrote about it last week, Dan, why the NBA needs to kill this 65-game rule. I've thought from the beginning it was dumb, it was unnecessary, and it only caused us to talk more about why these guys are injured more than if it was no game rule, 65-game rule at all. It just draws bad PR to the league in ways that I think it almost backfired, that now we can't just say Wemby's been great or Shai's been great. Now we got to kind of hold back and say, wait, are they tanking? Are they injured? These kind of caveats in the discussion are really not great for the league image and the league conversation. But unfortunately, because of the rules that they've implemented and the incentive structures in the league, is that it is part of the conversation. And so when I wrote that last week, I could have used a statement from the NBPA, but they decided to wait a week. I don't know why it took this long for them to come out strong for both Giannis and the Pistons against what's happening with the awards with Cade Cunningham. But the NBPA came out with statements on Tuesday, and my reaction was like, it's about time. First, let's talk about Cade. So Cade Cunningham has been out with a collapsed lung, a pneumothorax, I believe is what it's called, after colliding into another player, an unfortunate injury that will jeopardize his eligibility for All-NBA and MVP, because he has to make at least 65 games played, and he's falling short of that right now, and he's got to make it up. And I guess maybe there was a new, you know, a reevaluation of his lungs, and it's weird to be talking about this, and that like we have to caveat how awesome he's been this season with the fact that he's dealing with a pretty serious medical issue right now. But this is what the NBPA said on Tuesday, according to Shams Charani and others who have this statement. Cade Cunningham's potential ineligibility for postseason awards after a career-defining season is a clear indictment of the 65-game rule, and yet another example of why it must be abolished or reformed to create an exception for significant injuries, the union said through a spokesman. Since its implementation, far too many deserving players have been unfairly disqualified from end-of-season awards by this arbitrary and overly rigid quota. End quote. Couple of things here. All right. I'm glad they're coming out with a statement here. It would have been nice last week. But secondly, the Players Association agreed to this rule, Dan. So it's a little weird to be saying, hey, we need to get rid of this rule when the players agreed to this in 2023 after, Kawhi Leonard and Joel Embiid. Maybe you made some All-NBA teams that perhaps others were upset that they made it because they played 50, 60 some odd games instead of 82. But I understand why they're saying this and coming out strong in defense of Cade Cunningham here and what an awesome season he's had. But we have to mention to our audience that the NBPA agreed to this new rule in 2023. So, Dan, your reaction when you saw this come across the timeline on Tuesday?
Yeah, I mean, a few different things. One, I agree with the general sentiment of like, you should be allowed to vote for somebody who's played 60 or 61 games if you think that person was one of the five best players in the league for an MVP ballot or five best players in the league for an all-NBA first team. Like, as a voter, I don't understand why I don't have the leeway to be able to weigh and consider these things and make those determinations on my own. I think the league and players that that put that into effect for the purpose of like reducing the leeway that we get, I've never really been on board for that.
Bad idea.
I think that the specific case of Cade Cunningham, yeah, like, yes, I totally understand supporting his candidacy in this situation. I think it would be silly to say, like, this is not a, he's decided he's going to take every other night off. He had played in something like 90% of the Pistons games before somebody fell on his back. Like, this is somebody who earned his way into that situation. He got hurt going hard against the Wizards on a Tuesday or Monday in March. Like, if you're looking for an exemplar of what you're looking for down the stretch of the season, it's something like that, right? So that was my first thought about it. My other thought about it was, yeah, like, where was this kind of, we need to support the people who fall short due to legitimate arguments one way or the other when it was Embiid doing it? Like, it felt like the argument against, or the argument for doing this outside of Kawhi is load managing and everybody knows this. By the way, a guy with like a degenerative knee injury and like lower leg issues that have been persistent for years, right? So like, maybe there's an argument for why that was actually happening and it wasn't just that Kawhi wanted to get a night off here and there. Like, Embiid was the pivot point for a lot of this argument. And Embiid was like, played 51 games in the middle of a historic season in that 2022-23 year. And a lot of people didn't vote for him. They were like, oh, he's played fewer games. He shouldn't have gotten and so that's, I mean, I feel like the punishment, the carrot, the stick, whatever that we have to have there, like, is some people will say he shouldn't get the award and they won't vote for him. And like, I don't know why there needs to be something in that sense, why there needs to be something more significant of a punishment than the people who don't think that that's enough won't vote for them. I get the general idea of like, we need to make sure we're putting our superstars on the floor and on the screen as much as possible, when, especially in marquee national games, where we don't want to wind up getting a lower ratings number because the stars aren't out there. And you've written a number of times about the star, the sort of catastrophe of stars not being available at this point. This to me though feels like seeing a gunshot wound and saying we need to put a Band-Aid on it. Like, it doesn't address the root cause of why guys are getting injured. It doesn't address the root cause of why guys need more time off, why they might need a little bit more of a break. It doesn't address the root cause of like, this is a situation where a guy didn't need that rest. He just got injured on a bang bang play. And now he's, out on the, potentially going to miss out on it. Thank goodness at least he was able to, it wasn't the escalator concerns about his contract, his salary, which as a voter, I never wanted to have that be in my responsibility, like whether a guy makes first, second, third, whatever, being whether he gets his contract escalated to a higher level. But like, Cade already locked in his money before that, so thankfully he won't miss out on that. But there have been other guys, I think Jason Tatum a few years ago, where he wound up falling short and not making the team, and then like he wound up missing out on an opportunity to get an escalator. Like, none of this is stuff that we asked for. This is stuff that the powers that be determined and then negotiated. And as you mentioned, the players do have to bear some responsibility for this. I've also, as somebody who's like been part of a union negotiation, sometimes you've got to say yes to something to get something else, or you've got to give up something to get something else you want. So I don't know exactly what the horse trading was on this one. We know that the NBA they were definitely into getting this on board, having a player participation policy that emphasized we need our stars to play more games. And, as is so often the case with these big decisions that the league puts into play, there are downstream effects that nobody saw coming or nobody wanted to see coming. And now, we've got that going on, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah, how did we not see this coming? That there a guy who was very deserving would have an injury at the end of the season. And there is an exception. Okay, there is an exception in the rules that if you're out through, you have a medical issue or an injury that you're out through May 31st, a season-ending injury, you can apply for an exception if you fall short of the 65 game rule. This would not qualify under that that addendum. Like, it just wouldn't, because Cade Cunningham, it looks like, hopefully, you wouldn't be hearing from his agent and from the MBPA if he was ruled out for the season, because he would have a lever that he could pull to be granted an exception here. But because he might be coming back in a couple weeks, hopefully before the season ends, he wouldn't qualify under that exception. And maybe if he ends up with 60, he's at 60 qualified games right now. So he needs to play 5 more games the rest of the way. And it's going to come close, right? It's going to come close for Cade Cunningham. And they're already playing defense against the idea that if he plays 64 games because of a collapsed lung, we shouldn't hold it against him. I applaud them for doing that. I wish it would happen a little bit sooner, right when the news came, and that they could get ahead of this conversation. But this is a PR issue for the league. And I don't know why we need a 65 game rule. People have been like, Jaylen Brown did this. Jaylen Brown on a stream. I actually don't know exactly what stream this is or what show this was on, but Jaylen Brown was asked about this or commented about the 65 game rule and said he thinks it's interesting that everyone, I don't know who he's referencing there, but basically people wanted this and now they don't want it anymore. Interesting. You were so big on the 65 game rule initially and applauding this, but now you want to get rid of it. You're moving the goalpost, so to speak. I think for me, I can only speak for myself. I thought this was a bad idea from the start, because the game it's gotten so fast. The mileage has gotten so out of control in the league that if you're playing 65 games, that's the equivalent of playing 80 plus games 20 years ago, because of how many possessions and how much geometry they're covering. The sheer area of the floor that bigs and guards have to cover now because of the three-point shot and because of the pace, there's a reason why we're seeing more injuries now. And it's because the game is harder on the joints, and the soft tissue injuries we're seeing are, I think, medically, athletic trainers are saying the same thing, is that this is a direct result of the game changing and becoming a lot more violent on the joints. Not saying it's more violent than in the Bad Boy Pistons era. I'm saying it's just harder on the body to sustain 100 and 110 possessions a game at this kind of minutes, covering this much ground defensively. It's just a totally different sport. And you're placing the blame on the players. And I can't for the life of me understand why the players' union would sign off on this. But you raise a good point. In order to get something, you have to give up something in negotiations when it comes to collective bargaining. I wonder what that is. But Jaylen Brown, in this comment, he says, I would be for maybe a 62-game rule. This is so insulting to voters that we can't do this math for ourselves. We don't need a 65-game rule, because we're already measuring your production, how many games you played, the level of play that you had. And yes, Embiid won MVP while playing 66 games. So what? It's not like Jokic played every single game that year. He played 69 games compared to his 66. So, like, I don't think it's such a crime. It's such an atrocity that Embiid won MVP that year or got high in the All-NBA vote. This happens quite a bit that we say, you know what? Jokic might have been a little bit better, but is it worth the difference in 3 games? I mean, they essentially played the same number of games, and then you weigh all those variables together and you come out with a vote that Joel Embiid, in the year in which he averaged 33 points per game, deserved to be MVP for a really good Sixers team. I don't see why we need the 65 game minimum or a 62 game minimum. I see people, in reference to the article that I wrote last week, being like, well, what if, are you okay with a 40 game, someone playing 40 games and winning MVP? If he averaged 100 points a game, yeah, maybe he does deserve MVP if he just played 40 games. But that never happens. You know why?
It doesn't.
Because it's almost never, this exception, this outlier scenario, never happens, almost never happens. And so you're guarding against this insurance plan that, like, oh, so you'd be a guy winning the award with 50 games. Well, it depends. The best competition in that year, did that guy play 52 games? We all are capable of having this second line of thinking, of looking beyond points per game and seeing how many minutes did that guy play? How many games did he play? What kind of games did he play? Like, how did he perform in clutch scenarios? Like, highly leveraged opponents, high leverage games? How did he play defensively? We're breaking this down. We're serious people with these awards. And implementing a 65-game rule by the NBA standards and by the Players Union standards, it's insulting to media voters. It's insulting to players. If you're asked to rate your peers on any sort of award, implementing a 65-game rule, to me, it's insulting. And I don't even think I have an award this year. But the fact that you're demanding that there is a criteria for 65 games, it infers that we can't make these decisions for ourselves or weigh these variables ourselves. We, of course, factor in minutes played, games played in our calculus. We don't need to have a 65 game. We don't need to have a 60 game rule. Get rid of it entirely. Sorry.
NSO. What I think is interesting, Tom, though, is the other version of the other MBPA statement is also about who gets to make the decisions for themselves, because it sounds like there's a player who wants to make one decision for himself and his team wants to make a different decision for himself, and they are at odds right now.
Good segue. Thank you for doing this. Giannis Antetokounmpo is not playing right now. The Milwaukee Bucks are tanking. They just waived Cam Thomas just days after Doc Rivers claimed that he sees Jamal Crawford and Lou Williams in that guy, and they waived him. And they've lost a whole bunch of games here. I think in the month of March, they've won 3 games this month. Giannis Antetokounmpo has been dealing with injuries all year, but here's the statement from the MBPA regarding Giannis Antetokounmpo and the Bucks trying to shut him down. The player participation policy was designed by the league, interesting way to frame this, to hold teams accountable and ensure that when an all-star like Giannis Antetokounmpo is healthy and ready to play, he's on the court. Unfortunately, anti-tanking policies are only as effective as their enforcement. Fans, broadcast partners, and the integrity of the game itself will continue to suffer as long as ownership goes unchecked. We look forward to collaborating with the NBA on meaningful new proposals that will directly address and discourage tanking. Okay, Dan. So here we have the MBPA saying, oh, so you have these anti-tanking rules that you're hammering the Indiana Pacers and the Utah Jazz for shutting down Jaren Jackson Jr. or Lauri Markkanen or Pascal Siakam. But why aren't you doing the same thing for Milwaukee Bucks with Giannis Antetokounmpo? And I wonder how the NBA would respond to this, because maybe the team doctors are evaluating Giannis Antetokounmpo's injuries and saying he's actually not eligible to play despite what he says. Unfortunately, our team has not medically cleared him, but this is going to get messy. And I'm surprised it took this long for them to come out with a statement, but I'm glad they're doing it.
Yes. And the motivations on either side of it are the part that how the league responds, as I agree, will be interesting, because Adam Silver has been very adamant about saying, like, we are going to make more concerted efforts and stronger punishments for tanking, and we have to change the incentive structure. We've talked about this a number of times before. So long as the system rewards the teams with more losses with better odds of getting a number one pick or a top four pick or whatever, the tethering of your bad record and your high odds, like, it's going to lead teams to say it would be better for us to be bad. Even if you flatten the odds, even if you change the odds, if the structure still operates that way. And now you have a team that is acting in the and perhaps justifiably based on the actual injury, right? Maybe the medical information of Giannis again having another lower leg injury for the third or fourth time this season, leads the Bucks to say it is not health. It's not safe for you to get out there. We do not feel comfortable putting you back on the floor in terms of your long-term safety. And the idea of maybe that's right. And maybe it's a metagame, right? Maybe it's, we don't want to chance you getting one of those freak injuries that then makes it harder for us to entertain trade offers for you if and when you decide you don't want to sign an extension here. And we have to figure out, as you know, the Bucks owners are on the record now, I think, with Ramona Shelburne at ESPN being like, either he's going to sign an extension or he will be traded. That is what will happen next. So it's harder to trade a on the wrong side of 30 with a thickening medical jacket player who is currently rehabilitating an injury than one who has been healthy and raring to go for a while, right? To set aside, say nothing of the, yeah, the more games we lose, the better our draft pick is likely to be. And even though we're not great with you on the floor, we're better with you on the floor than we are with you off it. So it's just these competing incentives, right? And like, I get Giannis, the where Giannis comes in all this stuff and what his sort of drive is, maybe it's just sort of pure and saying like, I'm healthy, I want to play. But it does feel like so much of this season has been Giannis kind of like playing a little fast and loose with what his motivations are for these sorts of things. And I wouldn't presume to know. I'm not inside his head. I don't know his motivation. But the comments he's made repeatedly about what the supporting cast around him is, and maybe I don't know what the goal is. Maybe I decide today that I want this, and maybe tomorrow I decide I want something else. And as long as I can be out there playing, I want to compete. My whole goal is to compete for championship, like all that stuff. The best chance the Bucks have of returning to a competitive state is probably going to be to get a high-level draft pick that can either pair with Giannis or be traded for someone to pair with Giannis if, in fact, Giannis wants to stay. And so, but him being like, yeah, no, but like right now I want to play. That's interesting. I don't blame him for saying that, but I also, I'm very curious about whose motivations are what and what the sort of behind the scenes, conflicts are in Milwaukee that are leading us to this point, because it feels like, yeah, maybe this is just about what the, MRI says, but it feels like it's about a hell of a lot more than that.
Yeah, it does. And I think we should have seen this coming, is that this would arise out of this tank that attaching draft picks to reward ineptitude is one of the big sins of the league that we need to address and get rid of the draft, tying it to your record. I said this on the New Year's resolution, 7 New Year's resolutions for the NBA on New Year's Day. Number 2 on my list was abolish the draft, establish rookie free agency, because this situation with Giannis gets way uglier because the Milwaukee Bucks still have a pick here. They have the rights to the least favorable between theirs and New Orleans this year. New Orleans is terrible, and so Milwaukee, by virtue of them being terrible this year, well, I should say, as of late, they've been much better. Sorry, James Borrego and the New Orleans Pelicans. But by virtue of them not being a good team this year in the standings, Milwaukee Bucks have an incentive to tank. And disentangling those two things, how well you can get new players in the quote-unquote draft, not tying it to your record, I think would do so much for all the ills in the league. And a lot of the ills in the league are a result of tanking and the lack of trust with the audience that what we're watching is every team trying to win every game. And that is what you need first and foremost of any competitive league, is that it is competitive, that you're trying to compete to win. The third thing on that list of resolutions was eliminate the 65 game rule. Who could have seen this whole thing coming with Cade Cunningham? And the first thing, which can solve a lot of this, Dan, make it a 58 game regular season. But that was an argument for 29 games home and away against every other team. But now, Dan, it might be a 62 game season, because we could have a chance of 32 teams with expansion on the horizon, and some news today that I have to be careful with my wording of this, because as I saw the headline come across, I thought it was very soft what they were reporting. But the NBA Board of Governors approves exploration of expansion to Las Vegas and Seattle. They're not saying that they're going to Las Vegas and Seattle. They're approved a vote to explore bids and applicants for expansion teams in Las Vegas and Seattle. So they haven't decided that they're expanding. They're just exploring it, Dan. So with this, I think it should be a 62-game season so that you play the other 31 teams home and away twice, once at home, once at away. And that would solve a lot of these issues. So Vegas and Seattle, it looks like they're going to get teams. The NBA is putting out this figure, according to Shams Charani, of $7 to $10 billion asking prices, or expected to generate offers in that range. Interesting that that was in there too. I will just say, the only thing that is different than when we talked about this last week, Dan, is that LeBron James apparently has pulled himself out of the bidding for the Las Vegas through his Fenway Sports Group. So originally, everyone was excited about, hey, LeBron James could own a team in Las Vegas. He says he wants to own the team in Las Vegas, and now he's pulling out of that and saying he doesn't want to pursue that anymore, reportedly. So that is something that's different in this. Not only have they agreed to explore expansion, but LeBron James has pulled out of that purported chase to have the Las Vegas team. So Dan, we've been talking about this all season long. Any thoughts, new, fresh thoughts about the expansion news that we got today?
Main thing is, I think we need to be mindful of the brake pumping that's going to go along with this. As you said, it's like they've agreed to explore it. And the initial reporting was to get this spun up for the 28-29 season. And if they're, you know, but the follow-up report from Shops today was, now the NBA will examine Seattle and Vegas bids over the next several months and whether to execute the franchise purchases now or in a few years. So it's still possible that if they don't get those $7 to $10 billion bid numbers that they're looking for, or if they think that, you know, they could get a higher price and a higher premium in a couple of years after laying the groundwork for all this, you know, it could still be a wait. It's going to be, I mean, it will be a wait no matter what, but it could be a longer wait than I think we anticipate. In that situation, I think your point about LeBron saying that he's, you know, kind of out of the mix and Fenway Sports Group being out of the mix is also worth noting. Like, who is going to be the big bank to come in on these? Like, the $7 to $10 billion figure comes in the wake of, I believe it was like a little over $6 billion was the valuation for the Celtics when Bill Chisholm bought, and then the Lakers valuation at $10 million when the Dodgers owners got in there. So, like, who are the groups that are going to do that? You know, and this comes again in the wake of the loosening of restrictions of like private equity money and sovereign wealth funds being able to invest in teams. So like who's going to be the big banks? I think that's something to, it'll be interesting to see where those bids come from and at what level they come. And maybe it's, you know, it all happens quickly. I mean, you'd have to imagine that the league office wouldn't have gotten to this point, maybe with those, you know, ballpark numbers without a pretty good idea that they were going to be able to get them in short order. But, you know, who knows? Weird stuff can happen. In ownership situations, you know, we saw the whole, like, the Wolves are for sale. No, wait, they're not for sale. No, wait, does A-Rod own them? Does Mark Lurie, who's going to actually control the A-Rod, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it can get weird. Things can change. A couple of years away is still a long time and much can happen there. But it appears, if nothing else, that we are closer today to there being a Seattle Supersonics team than we have been in a couple of decades. And that ain't nothing.
Yeah, I still can't get over that they're couching this, you know, that they're exploring the idea of doing Vegas and Seattle. And the fact
legal
that
lawyers, man,
reporting, I know, but it makes me think that I feel like Seattle's a lock. I'm not so sure Las Vegas is a lock. I don't know why LeBron is pulling out of the bidding there, but it seems like to me the NBA is run by lawyers who are trying to leave open the possibility that we don't actually go to Vegas. I think it's interesting that they had that kind of language in there, that they're trying to get the $7 to $10 billion number out there, or at least reported by Shams Charania, the $7 to $10 billion figure. But after this news, I'm still a little bit reluctant to say it's a lock that the NBA goes. I don't know anything. But I think it's interesting that they've kind of been able to slow play this, and also the report that this might not come to fruition for a few years, that they're going to be looking at this for a few years before they actually can implement. So with that, Dan, I invite you to go in with me if you want on a Vegas team, if you want. So maybe they're waiting for us to do that, to put in our bids.
That's got to be what it is. Yeah, I mean, my daughter asked yesterday why we don't own one of the like giant colonial houses on the walk to school. So I got to come up with a scratch for that, and then I'll come up with a scratch for the Vegas team. We'll go there.
Yeah, we're a long ways. We got to figure out a financial plan for us to get that Vegas team. That's why it's going to take a few years to put these bids together.
Yep.
Dan, this is great. We got 10 games left in the season. I'm sure there will be a lot more award controversies next week. So can't wait to weigh in on those and see what happens next week, next Wednesday. I want to thank Brad, Emmy, Sarah, and Ryan behind the scenes for pulling this show together. We're going to do Kevin O'Connor tomorrow live at 11:30. And there's some Sweet 16 stuff. I know people are watching a lot of college basketball these days, but want to thank everyone for tuning into this show. And make sure you subscribe to us at Yahoo NBA on YouTube. And wherever you listen to podcasts, go leave us a 5-star review. I appreciate that. Dan, thanks so much for doing this. And we'll be back again next week.
Take it easy, everybody.